Okay, our text this morning is going to be Acts chapter 27. And in this chapter, the Apostle Paul is going to leave Judea for the last time. And our writer, Luke, is going to take this journey with the Apostle Paul. And he's going to provide a first-hand, vivid account of the sea journey towards Rome. So, as you can imagine, it's an account filled with geography and nautical terms. It's really a lesson in an adventure lesson in travel across a hazardous Mediterranean Sea. So it is high drama, and he's very much like an adventure writer, and he's going to capture the dangers of this open sea voyage. And in the end, it will result in shipwreck, as we'll see next week. But at the same time, there's always the assurance of God's providence. And you have within it the lessons of how the means and the ends are so profoundly inseparable. And he also gives us a lesson, the Apostle Paul does, in how we are supposed to live in light of that. And we'll see that. But you remember over the last few chapters, you have the parallels between the five trials of Christ and then the Apostle Paul, and they're played out in history. And you recall that the first defense that Paul made was essentially to the Jewish people, which he gave from the steps of the Roman barracks after the riot at the temple. And then the second defense or trial was in front of the Sanhedrin, which is the high court of Judaism. Of course, you remember that wasn't much of a trial. The high priest had Paul struck in the mouth when he first tried to speak. But then in the end, the Sanhedrin itself degenerated into this scuffle between Pharisees and Sadducees. And it was so violent that Paul had to be rescued again by the Roman troops. The third defense was in Caesarea. It was in front of the Roman procurator Felix. And you remember that Paul had been brought to the governor for two reasons, basically. One, the Roman commander in Jerusalem was at a loss to understand why the riot had begun in the first place, nor why the Sanhedrin wanted Paul dead. Second, the Romans had learned that the Sanhedrin had plotted to murder Paul, and so in effect he was sent to the governor for safety. But Felix had no better understanding of why Paul was hated by the Jews than the commander. Even the Jews who presented their case through a professional prosecutor, even by the time they're done, the governor is still unclear as to what this is all about. But what is clear is that Felix did not view Paul as guilty of a crime. But at the same time, he was content to leave him imprisoned. Therefore, Paul was left in custody for 2 years in Herod's old palace in Caesarea. There he languished until Felix was recalled back to Rome. And we've been following the events around his replacement over the last couple of weeks. The new governor was Festus, and he was generally considered to be a better man, a better ruler than Felix. But he too, like most politicians, took more into account than simple justice. He was weighing several other factors other than whether guilt or innocence. That's kind of what politicians tend to do. But to his credit, on his first journey to Jerusalem, he politely yet firmly rejected the demands of the Sanhedrin to turn Paul over to them. Instead, he convened a hearing back in Caesarea. Now, at that hearing, the Jews took an even more aggressive stance than they had the first time. Basically, they stood around the Apostle Paul and they were hurling charges at him. But once again, Paul's defense should have been enough to dismiss all of these charges. And as we said last time, the problem for the Jews was they needed a civil charge in order to put him to death, but their case was only theological. And the Romans didn't care about the theological case. So Festus here faced the same dilemma as Felix had. He was either going to offend the Jews or offend justice. Now, it's possible that Festus tried to get Paul to alleviate the problem himself by agreeing to be tried in Jerusalem. That would have pleased the Jews. Probably would have been ended up in the same way as this kangaroo court that actually had Christ killed. But instead, Paul alleviated the problem in another way. He appealed directly to Caesar, and it didn't take long for Festus and his advisors to agree to this, because that solved their problem. Their only problem they had was that none of them knew how to convey the charges, nor describe the case as they're sending it off to the emperor. From the first riot, none of what had revolved around the Apostle Paul had made any sense to the Romans. And so Festus looked for help from King Agrippa II, who was versed in both Roman law and Judaism, and King Agrippa and his sister had just arrived in Caesarea for their first state visit to the new governor, and that's where we began last time. Festus and Agrippa held this elaborate reception within the praetorium, filled with pomp and spectacle, and it was attended by the top military and civil leaders, and Paul was brought to the center of this hall and placed amongst them. And then Festus announced the purpose, which was for Agrippa to hear the accused in order that a report on the case could be written. Because as Festus himself declared, even though the whole Jewish people had petitioned him to have Paul killed, he said, "I found that he had done nothing deserving death." And so he then turned to Paul and gave him the floor to speak. Now, we saw last time Paul recounted how he had long been a part of the Pharisees, the strictest of all the Jewish sects, and how he had pursued the Christians to both prison and to death. He retold the events on the road to Damascus when the risen Christ appeared to him and spoke to him. Even though the rest of those on the road only saw a great light, heard a great noise, he actually saw the risen Christ and he actually heard him speak to him. And we saw last time at how in Christ's short message to Paul that day, you could write whole chapters of theology. But what Paul told Agrippa was that he had been true to the commission of the vision that he had been given. And he had preached throughout Judea and then to the Gentiles. And for this, the Jews had tried to kill him. But preaching directly then to King Agrippa, Paul said that what the Jews opposed was, quote, nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass, that the Christ must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. So he's basically saying that he is in this continuous path from the prophets and from Moses all the way up through, and that Christ is the high point, the culmination of all that they had prophesied. And so he was actually being true to Judaism, and it's the Jews, in fact, who are trying to thwart redemptive history. But in the end, the Roman Festus thought such talk was ludicrous, especially about Jesus rising from the dead. And Agrippa himself was unconvinced of the gospel. Yet all of them agreed that Paul was guilty of nothing worthy of punishment. But regardless of guilt or innocence, sending Paul out of Palestine was very convenient to the governor. Therefore, to Rome he would go. And symbolically, the story of redemptive history was now leaving Judea and shifting west, leaving its Jewish past for its Gentile future. And that brings us to chapter 27. The Apostle Paul embarks for Rome along with his companions, Luke and Aristarchus, something like that. Verse 1. Yeah, there we go. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. So now Luke's narrative here we see returns to first-person pronoun. That is, we set sail. So he is with them. This is a first-hand account of Luke. And as I said here, it includes Paul and Luke and Aristarchus. And Aristarchus is this Thessalonian convert who was one of the contingent of followers who had traveled with Paul during his third missionary journey. We see when we look earlier in Acts, we see that he had been in Ephesus during the riot. He had actually been one of those who had been dragged into the stadium by the crowd. And he had come to Judea with Paul as one of the envoys, so to speak, of the Gentile churches who were bringing this offering to James and the elders at Jerusalem. So he is representing the Gentile churches. And then from Paul's later letters, we find him being called Paul's fellow prisoner. So he seems to have accompanied Paul all the way to his arrest in Rome. Now, as we follow Luke's account, we see Paul and a group of other prisoners now being turned over to a centurion. He's named here as Julius. He's part of a legion given the honorary title, imperial title of Augustan. That was often given to cohorts who were responsible for passing military orders between Rome and the outer provinces. Okay, so basically they're saying, obviously all the military belonged to the emperor, but in this Augustan cohort, they were responsible for direct communication between the imperial court and the outer provinces. Now, who these other prisoners were is unknown, but Paul likely had a higher status than any of these. And we see that actually in his later treatment. These were probably not citizens on their way to an imperial appeal like the Apostle Paul. They were probably convicts on their way to being victims in the games. It's also been suggested that in order to travel with Paul, Luke and Aristarchus acted as Paul's attendants, literally seen as his slaves. That would have also enhanced Paul's status, but it would also have allowed them to travel with Paul, who is, remember, still a prisoner. So they're traveling probably as his attendants. Now, the first thing that Julius had to do was to find passage. Military ships weren't usually wasted on prisoner transport, so he had to secure passage aboard a merchant ship that could hold both his prisoners and whatever number of troops were doing the escort. And what he found was a merchant ship from the city of Adramidium, which is one of the ports on the western shore. You recall this is near where Paul had come down on his way back to Palestine. And that's what these coasting ships did, was to go up and down the eastern Mediterranean carrying grain and goods between Macedonia and Asia and Egypt. But it would take Julius to a port where he might find then an open sea vessel bound for Rome. In other words, it's kind of like if the equivalent today would be commuter jets taking you to a hub, then taking you on some international flight. So you had these smaller vessels going up and down the coast that would bring you to a port where you then could take a larger vessel and get to Rome. And that's basically what he's trying to do. And so beginning with verse 3, Luke begins charting this journey. And he does it in the same detail that he described Paul's return from Asia. Remember how specific he was on times and places that he went. So it's clearly a first-hand account. And just like someone has viewed that trip, that journey down the coast back to Palestine, people have looked at the places that they went and the times that they went, and that's meticulously been confirmed for that time of year. So it is a true first-hand account. And we're going to see that this entire voyage takes place in the face of the western winds of late summer, early autumn, until you get that switch. Okay? And so that's going to be important. It's going to lead actually to the shipwreck. And so it's around the year 60 AD, and the journey begins in verse 3. It says, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra and Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. So upon leaving Caesarea, the first stop is Sidon. That's a port in modern-day Lebanon. It's just up the coast. And we see a remarkable kindness that was given to Paul by Julius. Sidon had a Christian church there, one that F.F. Bruce suggests was founded after the Exodus following Stephen's stoning. So it's early on. But Julius allowed Paul to be taken to fellow believers and to be cared for while they were in port, which is pretty remarkable considering he officially is a prisoner. But that shows his elevated status as a Roman citizen who is on this imperial appeal, and you can kind of relate to it. If he goes to the emperor, he wins his appeal, and then he says, oh, by the way, this centurion treated me poorly, he could be in trouble, right? So he doesn't. And we'll also see that in the end, it's pretty clear that Julius actually has an affection for the Apostle Paul. But how long they were in Sidon is not clear. But there's a sense throughout Luke's account here of a race against nature, you might say. So they're likely not there long. The winds were against them, and yet they needed to outrun the change that would come with the winter storms. And so when they set sail again, they stayed to the lee of Cyprus, meaning they stayed to the east and the north of it, using the island itself to block the winds out of the west. And so from off of Cyprus then, where Paul's first missionary journey had begun, they crossed to the southern coast of modern Turkey and landed at the small port of Myra. Myra, just another city on the southern coast of the peninsula there. The only thing that's interesting about Myra really is the cliffs above the city were honeycombed with tombs. It was called the necropolis, the city of the dead. That's something that when he came into port he would have seen. But Luke also mentions Cilicia. That's Paul's home province. And so we can imagine Paul standing on the stern. He's looking east, knowing he would never see his family in Tarsus again. Which, they probably had disowned him anyway. We know that he had a relationship with his sister. Remember, it's his nephew actually finds out about the plot. But other than that, he may not have seen his family anyway from the time that he converted. We're not given that information. But essentially now, in Myra, Julius eventually found passage on one of the large grain ships that routinely traveled from the breadbasket of the Nile to Rome and back. And in verse 7, they began trying to make their way against the winds along the western coast. Verse 7, we sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmon. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasea. And so the ship slowly made its way along the coast until the winds simply would not allow them to go any further. And so they turned south. And they're wanting to make their way east of the island of Crete, again using the island to block the winds. But then passing south of the island, they still had to travel west. And so coasting along the southern shore of Crete, that proved to be very, very difficult, and they finally reached a place called Fair Havens. So progress has been very, very slow. That's what Luke is telling us. They've, with much difficulty at this time of year, trying to go west against the winds. Very, very difficult and very slow progress. But now open sea lay ahead, and the season was clearly coming against them. And we see that in verse 9. It says, since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Now, the fast he mentions here is the Great Day of Atonement, meaning it was well into September or October, depending on what year it was. But regardless, the treacherous season for travel by sea had begun. And as a seasoned traveler, Paul knew this, as well as the crew knew it. And so at Fair Havens, the crew and the ship owner held a meeting to decide their next course of action. And Paul seems to have been invited, again showing his elevated status. And so his advice was to winter where they were. Now understand that what he told them here was likely just simple common logic. It wasn't divine insight. Nor do we see Paul taking providence for granted. That would have made him guilty of putting God to the test. If he had done that, he would have said, well, let's put out to open sea. I've got a promise that I'm going to reach Rome. I don't know about you guys. You may not make it, but I've been told I'm going to go reach Rome, so let's just go ahead. He doesn't do that either. He lives by common sense. But in reality, for all gathered there that day, there was no question of going on. They weren't going to attempt it. The debate was really over where to winter the vessel, not whether to sail to Rome. To them, that was out of the question. They had come to the southern coast of Crete to avoid being driven against the rough northern coast, but there weren't that many good ports on the southern side. Fair Havens was not the best harbor, and yet it was sheltered from the winter winds, and so Paul urges them to stay where they are. But what the pilot and the owner wanted to do was to swing around to a place called Phoenix, one of the better harbors. But the danger they faced was that beyond Fair Havens, the terrain of the island itself made the shelter from Crete minimal. That left boats open to winds out of the northeast. In verse 11, notice how it's the centurion who has the final say, and it's a fateful one. That's where they're trying to reach. Verse 11, but the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southeast and northwest, and spend the winter there. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind, called the Northeaster, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. And so they're waiting. There's this gentle breeze that comes up. They say, okay, we can make a break for it. And they set sail. And they're trying to stay close to shore. They're trying to stay within the shelter of the island. They're only a few hours from safety. And then came this Northeaster. Whoops. Sorry, getting off. And this Northeaster then, this ripping winds began driving the vessel south. South and west, away from the shore. And after struggling to keep their way, they finally gave the ship its head and let it be driven by the wind. They simply couldn't fight it anymore. It was useless. Now, this is a large vessel, probably 140 feet or so in length, 45 feet wide, difficult to handle. And this gale had struck so quickly, they hadn't even had time to perform the most simple preparations for the open sea and for storms. But in verse 16, they were allowed a brief moment to do so. And Luke tells us that running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. And so what he's saying is that south of Crete is this small island of Cauda. At some point, the ship was given some relief from the wind by the island, not to make it to safety. They couldn't do that, but to at least prepare for the open sea. And the first thing they did was to pull up the dinghy, the small boat that ships usually towed behind them. That's what usually took a ship in harbor back and forth to the shore. Well, in a storm, they either had to cut it loose or to pull it up on the deck. And so Luke says that with great difficulty, they were able to get it up on the deck. And then remember, they're still caught in gale winds and rough seas, but it had lessened just enough to let them make these preparations. And so second thing they did was these boats carried these rope cables that in the face of rough weather and storms, they would basically attach them on either side and they would throw it up over the bow and the ship would basically run over it and then they'd tie it up. And what they were doing was they were basically binding the wood planks of the ship together so that it would keep it from falling apart and breaking up in rough seas. Now, the last thing they did was that they assessed where they were being driven. If the gale lasted for days and they did nothing, they would have eventually been blown onto the coast of Syrtis, this desolate coast of North Africa where there is nothing. It's basically the reason why ships going from Alexandria in Egypt, where all the grain was in the Nile Delta, why they didn't just go straight up to Italy. Because if something happened and the winds were wrong, you're doomed. Okay? You're gonna crash onto the coast of North Africa and there's nothing there. That's why they typically wanted to stay close to the shore. And they went around the eastern end of the Mediterranean. And so when they look at this, they're basically, Luke's telling them, we don't want to end up there. So they lowered the gear. That is, they lowered the sails to slow themselves down. And they probably even threw out some anchors. They're not anchors that hit the bottom, but they basically drag in the water to try and slow their progress. But of course, all of this, they're nothing but desperate measures to face the inevitable. That is, they could not prevent themselves from being thrown into the open Mediterranean and into the brunt of the storm. And we see in verse 18, it says, since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. And so they're throwing over the cargo to lighten the ship, because they're struggling to keep the ship from filling with water and being swamped. And then after 3 days, they took the desperate measure of bringing down the spar, the main mast, because the main mast is almost as long as the ship itself, and if the storm brought it down, you're basically going to crush the ship. So they basically tore it down themselves, threw it overboard, and of course it must have been a terrible struggle to do that in gale winds. And then verse 20. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Luke is such a great writer, isn't it? He says in verse 21, since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God, of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship, and he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island. And so for 11 days then, this ship was but a tiny piece of flotsam on the raging sea. There's no break in the clouds that show the sun or stars, only these thick rolling curtain of clouds. The storm is on them. All hope was gone, and in sickness and despair, no one had eaten for days. And then Paul stands amongst them, and he is basically as a prophet, announcing the will of God. Of course, not before giving them a well-deserved but thoroughly human, I told you so. You should have listened to me. But he tells them the ship's going to be lost. But God had granted him the lives of every person on board. So the implication here is that Paul had been praying for all of their safety, and that God had answered those prayers and had granted Paul, it says, the lives of everyone on board. He also tells them this is not some hope or intuition. It was the direct revelation of an angelic messenger. That becomes very important theologically in light of how Paul reacts to events later. In other words, given that Paul knew with certainty how it would end, we see that Paul continues to react and to urge actions as if the end depended on it. And in reality, it really did. Because God not only decreed the end, he decreed the means to reach that end. And that includes Paul's persuasion of the crew, which we're going to see a little bit later. But now we see, continuing on, verse 27, it says, when the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So the crew suspected, and they probably suspected this by the sound of breaking waves. It's around midnight. Somewhere out in the dark was land. They'd been out there for 2 weeks. And so hearing probably the crashing of the waves, they began to take soundings, and that was to let down weighted, knotted ropes to gauge the depth, right? And so the readings confirmed their fears that the waters were getting more and more shallow. Without the light of day, there was little hope of staying off the rocks. So they threw out anchors and they prayed for day to come. But Paul had already told them the ship itself would be lost, but the people saved. Yet in verse 30, we see how Paul continued to use language that threatened a different possibility if they left the ship, even though that possibility could not agree with the revelation that he had received. All that means is that the interaction of the ends and the means are simply too deep for us to expect to live by the ends, as if we could ignore the means. It is the height of presumption on our part if we do so. So despite the assurance of their safety, Paul knew by common sense that the crew needed to stay with the ship and not abandon their passengers. And his common sense and the means of providence are actually the same thread. God's using Paul's common sense and then his urging of action according to common sense to achieve the ends that he had already decreed. And so we see in verse 30. It says, "And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved.' Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go." And so what we see here is that the sailors are attempting to sneak off with this dinghy, this small boat, and leave the passengers to their own fate. They're lying about trying to set some more anchors. They're trying to get on the boat. "Yeah, we'll be back in a minute." But Paul told Julius that their lives depended on the crew staying. So the soldiers go and they cut the boat away, preventing the crew's escape. He goes on, "As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength. For not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you.' And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea." Now, one thing was common in the ancient world, that you judged philosophers or seers by their behavior in crisis. And so Paul's calmness here gave credence to his claims of having divine assurance of his safety. In other words, if Paul had been panicked, it would have been evidence that he didn't even believe his own story that they were going to be saved. But here with the ship about to run aground and all of them to be thrown into the sea, he calmly urges them to eat for their strength. And he even pauses to give thanks. And that's a tremendous testimony, isn't it? And for the first time, Luke gives us the number of people involved, 276, much larger than we might have suspected. That makes the fact that none of these would lose their lives all the more astounding. And so what we see here, we see Paul's faith in what God had promised him. He is acting upon that faith. He is encouraging them to take actions according to that revelation. "You're going to be safe. It's okay. Eat." Even though they're about to face a tremendous peril. We also see that God had sent that assurance, right? God could have, in providence, calmed the winds, done whatever. But he says, "No, you're going to go through this trial. But I'm giving you this assurance. In the end, you will be safe. Not only that, but I have answered your prayers for all 276 people, that they too will be safe." And that too is a great testimony. And so what we see is even in this journey, God is providing authentication of the Apostle Paul. We'll see that later on when he's on Malta. There are events taking place that even in this journey to Rome, he's showing this is someone who has the divine blessing of God. Okay, and then next week we'll look at the actual shipwreck that is on Malta and what takes place there.